from nationally and internationally respected industry experts on the details of how we advance these foundational elements of privacy and trust. The work they're presenting today represents significant collective effort over the past several years of government, industry, industry associations, and standard organizations. And we wanted to frame it up front in terms of the why. We believe mobile driver's license represents the future of identity in America and really has the potential to significantly impact the quality of life and access to services for individuals, while also reducing the fraud and friction for organizations needing to trust that the identity information of a customer is valid and accurate. Securely enabling people's identity on their device and under their control is the foundation of how we enable trust and choice in a modern world. And if you'll advance to trust, so we can double click on that. Trust in the mobile driver's license is a multifaceted opportunity that's really tied to the trust in the underlying process used by the DMV to establish the identity, and then in the binding of the identity to the device, which is also signed by the state. We're going to go into the details of both of those later in this webinar, but the chain of trust is much stronger and more auditable with a mobile driver's license than with what we're accustomed to today. From an individual's perspective, mobile driver's license promotes trust because the individual has greater transparency and control in the exchange of their information and will be able to maintain a consent receipt that gives people a way of proving what they shared. So trust in this model is being reinforced through greater accountability. You may notice that in this vision statement, we don't explicitly call out privacy. Trust and privacy are relational. Simply, the less I trust you, the more privacy I will demand, and vice versa. We as a community need to think about trust and privacy more broadly than just in absolute terms, and stop thinking about them as zero-sum game between individuals and organizations who are engaging in identity transactions. Trust is earned through demonstrated consistency, and when there is trust, it becomes an exchange and discussion around consent. Providing a choice begins to establish trust. Consent is a decision to share. And as you can see, when we double click on choice here, today with a physical driver's license, the choice is really all or none when sharing our information, which leaves us constantly overexposing information. A widely used example to highlight this trade-off is when showing your driver's license to purchase alcohol. It's not necessary for the bartender or cashier to know your actual age, only that you're eligible to purchase it and over 21 in the United States. And it certainly isn't necessary for the bartender to know your home address or your weight, for instance. With mobile driver's license, we're able to minimize the data to just what is necessary for a given transaction, making the data being requested easy for an individual to understand and giving them the choice and control of what they want to share. There's also another aspect of choice that a mobile driver's license provides that is superior to the physical driver's license we're accustomed to. And that's the choice of channel through which an individual wants to engage. Today, our physical driver's license is inflexible and difficult to use in a digital context. But your mobile driver's license can provide you a consistent way of asserting your identity across in-person and online channels, thus opening up the number of ways you can engage and increasing the value you get as an individual from your state-issued driver's license. Which leads me to the last part of our vision statement, modern world. And if we can click through to include both of those for modern and world, the future of identity needs to be safely and securely enabling individuals to engage with all sorts of transactions from a device in the palm of their hand. For our increasingly digital lives, we need an identity credential that is purpose-built to support transactions we want to engage in person, online, and in the future. Getting identity right is central to enabling digital transformation for so many industries and government services, which is why the promise of mobile driver's license is so exciting, as a better identity credential issued by your state DMV can not only address concerns with security and fraud, but also improve privacy and enable new types of trusted services to be offered to a broader group of Americans online. We really hope this vision statement interests and inspires all of you to engage to help us build the future of identity in America. The task is as daunting as it sounds, and it'll take all the stakeholders on this webinar working together to make sure we get it right and maximize the value to all participants in the identity ecosystem. Each of us has a part to play, and we hope you'll join us on this exciting journey. With that, I'll turn it over to John Wunderlich to discuss the privacy-enhancing features of the mobile driver's license. John?
Thanks, Matt. Just confirming everyone can hear me.
Yes.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So I want to frame this discussion around something that a lot of people on this call may be familiar with, which is the Plan, Do, Check, Act paradigm for continuous improvement. It's been my experience, whether in privacy or security, that it is that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and that if you can deliver good privacy today, that's better than perfect privacy in the future. And how you do that is using a continuous improvement cycle. And I've framed it this way. The design, the planning is the design and the architecture, much of which has been captured in the ISO standard, the 8013-5. But there's also the implementation. It doesn't always help if you design the perfect system and then people implement it badly. So the delivery of privacy to fulfill what Matt talked about or build the trust is how do you implement the MDL in your jurisdiction or in your industry? Because without implementing it in a trusted and privacy enhancing way, you fail the design requirements that you start with. And then to close the loop, you have to make sure that you have audit and accountability capabilities so that you can demonstrate that your promises have been fulfilled. It's also the case that no system is perfect and there will be incidents. And how you manage the incidents, most people most of the time will accept that people and systems make mistakes. That's not what poisons the trust. It's how you respond to the incident or the breach. That's what can really damage the trust. And you come back and you review and you update. None of these things should be check once and forget exercises in terms of ensuring that you make privacy. Those of us who have lived in the crypto world know that crypto standards change, other standards change, identity standards change, password standards change. So you have to review and update your design and your implementation on an ongoing basis. So framing it that way, I think is how I think we should look at the MDL ecosystem. Next slide, please, Kathy. So if you look at NXE in the standard, you'll find that they've captured the privacy by design principles in NXE. And if you look for privacy by design elsewhere on the web, you'll find these seven fundamental principles for privacy, which frames the design architecture. And if you're a architect or an implementer, you can also do a search on the web for frameworks or certifications that dive into much more detailed control frameworks or control requirements based on these privacy by design principles. But just very briefly, if you look at those principles and some of the elements of the MDL architecture captured in the standard, for example, the data, the fact that the data transfer model presumes user involvement at every step. That engages principles 1, 3, and 6. It's proactive because you've built that into the design. Number 3, and it provides visibility and transparency because the user is present during the transaction. It's section 6.2 in the standard. Critical to any kind of privacy or data protection is enabling user choice. This ensures that the person has autonomy and agency. And there's as many definitions of privacy out there as there are people or opinions. And my definition of privacy may well vary depending on the context. When I'm at the office in the morning, or when I'm in the theater district in the evening, or when I'm at home in the middle of the night, I have different privacy expectations in different information contexts. But one of the things that holds true to those from the perspective of implementing an ecosystem is user autonomy and agency. To the extent that the MDL holder, in the context of this, has choice and control, that's facilitating the implementation of privacy. So the fact that all MDL transactions are initiated by the MDL holder is very privacy protective. So again, section 6.3.2.1. The data minimization is enabled, which enables privacy embedded by design. I'll make a side note here with my Cantera hat on. We've just published a report called the Blinding Identity Taxonomy, which provides guidelines for implementers who want to remove identity information from data sets. That might help, along with ISO 20889, which provides some more specific guidelines on data minimization and de-identification. And finally, the talk about the biometric templates, the notion that if you're going to use a biometric, you want to not keep a raw copy of a picture of my face or a picture of my thumbprint or an iris print, but rather use a cryptographically hashed representation of that, so that after enrollment, you have no persistence of something that can be used in other contexts. You only have the biometric template that provides you a go, no go on whether the presenter of the driver's license matches the biometric. All of these fulfill a variety of the privacy by design architecture requirements. Next slide, please. So fulfilling design, so the implementation challenges. So I talked about user initiation, minimum data transfers, and secure data transfers, but how you implement that, right? So as a person who provides advice to enterprises and as a former advisor to a regulator, some of the things that we look for in an implementation. Oh, and by the way, a side note for marketing people is, I'm always a little skeptical when I see an implementer claim compliance with a regulation like the GDPR, or in Canada where I am from, PIPEDA. That's kind of like the manufacturer of a car claiming that their car is compliant with the traffic laws of the state. Right. It's certainly the case that you can use the car to maintain be within the context of the traffic laws, but the user of the car can still speed and violate the laws. So be careful about the claims that you make. On the other hand, when there's a standard, as we're talking about here, the MDL standard, you can certify and test that your implementation is in conformance with the standard. And that's a much stronger claim to make when and if you're faced with a regulator or civil action. So how do you, other than the attestation of the controls itself, what are some of the implementation controls? So in a proactive sense, making sure that you have training awareness for the project staff and understanding the importance of non-functional requirements before going live. Oftentimes, for example, when you're dealing with programmers or data geeks, they look at the functional requirements and say, as long as we get the functional requirements good, then we're good to go from alpha to beta, maybe even on an MVP. Some of the non-functional requirements regarding privacy and security, it's really important to make sure that everybody in the project understands that you identify which of the non-functional requirements are and must be part of the MVP. Otherwise, going live gives rise to a corporate risk. Assessments during the requirement and design processes. If you're in Europe, you might be familiar with data protection impact assessments, DPIA. In North America, you might have heard of privacy impact assessments, PIAs. Both of those are on the sort of privacy data protection front. On the security front, you may well have heard of threat risk assessments, and that might include pen tests and other tests. Doing those assessments at a conceptual and a logical and a physical level during your development lifecycle provides good touchstones and guidelines to keep your project team on a path for delivering and being able to deliver on the trust that we talk about. And finally, to make sure it's not a checkpoint exercise, part of your design process and implementation controls is once the system has been designed for a particular jurisdiction, have we put in metrics and reporting for the readers, for MDL holders, for the applications, for the regulator and the public to provide ongoing attestations and proof that we're doing what we say we're doing. It's not sufficient in the kind of broad public context of something like an MDL ecosystem to say, you know what, 3 years ago we had an attestation that we're good, we'll let you know if the situation changes. You can imagine how that's not going to play well with all the stakeholders in the system. Next slide, please. And finally, closing the loop, to continue that thought. Many of you will have heard, what's the biggest lie on the internet? Yes, I have read and understood the terms and conditions, yada, yada, yada. Or maybe you've heard you've seen headlines about the death of privacy. The first headline I've seen about the death of privacy was in a Newsweek 1969-ish cover. So the death of privacy is kind of like the birth of cold fusion. It's just around the corner, and it has been for 50 years. So don't expect that, notwithstanding technological or other changes, people's expectations for respect for their privacy and autonomy is going to change. And how do you do that? Close the loop and show the MDL holders why they should continue to trust you. Your system, if you don't do that, become an adverse headline, a breach, an MDL reader chooses has a fault in their system, and there's a breach. Pick a scenario. There's going to be a breach. Are you set up to demonstrate that the breach is the exception and not representative of the system as a whole? And that's how you get through that bump in the road on the way to building more transparent and trustworthy ecosystem. How do you do that? If you're doing privacy impact assessments, publish summaries of them. If there's a breach, be transparent. What happened? How did we deal with it? What did we learn from it? How are we going to improve on that? If this is consistent with your jurisdiction's rules and ability, provide a portal so that the holder of a driver's license can see who's had access to their data or where their data has been used, so they have transparency throughout the life cycle. Thanks, Matt, for mentioning consent receipts. If somebody collects my data for use and a purpose, why do I not get a receipt for that in much the same way as I provide cash or a credit card payment for any other transaction? That's the kind of thing that provides that kind of transparency. I'll leave you with the thought that if a user is surprised when they discover how their data is being used, that's probably a privacy fail. You haven't provided appropriate notice, or the notice has been buried, or the system is acting in a way different than a person would expect in the context of the jurisdiction. So if there's no surprises, then you're going to be able to build trust. So with that, I think, and I look forward to the conversation and questions later, I'll hand it over to Ted.
I'm here to talk about involved in being a smart digital identity consumer. It is first worth considering from where an identity comes and how reliable it is. In other words, how much confidence should a relying party have that the ID establishes the person is who he or she claims to be? This figure represents the interdependence at the center of an assessment of risk and impact. Basically, what are the consequences of error or fraud? In some cases, the consequences are minimal, like issuing a discount card at a grocery store. So not a lot of time or resources need to be spent on proofing. On the other end of the spectrum, the consequences can be very grave, such as for programs granting access to classified information. In those cases, there is a lot of resources and a lot of time spent on proofing the identity. The risk assessment should inform all elements of the identity ecosystem, and any group that is relying on an enrolled identity should really understand what kind of risk assessment and what level of proofing is done. Could we go on to the next? The 2018 ANSI-NASPO standard on identity proofing lays out a four-step process for enrolling an identity. Relying parties can use this framework in deciding whether a type of ID is suitable for its purposes. Step one is a preliminary or design stage. This includes the risk assessment that we just discussed, which then uses that risk assessment to inform what information is collected from the applicant and what procedures are used to look for errors or fraud. Step two is assertion, that is bringing the identity down to an individual level. The individual claims an identity, usually in the form of a combination of biographic data, sometimes tied to a biometric. The identity provider resolves the claimed identity to a unique individual. In other words, this process should prevent Ted Sobel from DHS from being confused with Ted Sobel, who is a professional weightlifter in California. It lays out combinations of biographical data that can be used to achieve a high degree of accuracy in assertion. At DHS, we primarily use full name and date of birth, supplemented with sex, to minimize misidentifications when vetting nearly 2 million air travelers per day. Step three, verification. What supporting evidence is required to link the claim identity to the individual? Safeguards might include training employees to spot fraud, electronic verification of documents, checks against source records, forensics, testimonials. The process in place should really support the risk assessment and determine in step one and provide an appropriate level of assurance. Step four is the determination, a yes or no decision on whether the individual is who he or she claims to be. So if you understand steps one through three, you will know whether you can rely on step four, the determination. Next slide, please. Well, each state determines for itself the enrollment process used to issue driver's licenses, so you'll find that the process varies. Far from a static system, states are constantly updating and enhancing their issuance and production processes. The American Association for Motor Vehicle Administrators, AMVA, assists through guidelines and sharing of best practices to promote driver's licenses, security, and interoperability. Because the federal government relies heavily on driver's licenses as proof of identity, Congress passed the Real ID Act of 2005, establishing voluntary minimum standards for the secure issuance and production of state-issued driver IDs. The Real ID Act and regulations lay out security requirements needed for the federal government to be able to accept a driver's license for entering federal facilities, boarding commercial aircraft. About two-thirds of Real ID concerns identity proofing. So as a result, the federal government would be able to accept for those two official purposes only driver's licenses that are compliant with Real ID, I think now starting in October of 2021. But as a word of caution, as we approach nationwide compliance with Real ID, not all licenses that you're going to encounter will be Real ID compliant. Most states continue to offer their residents the option of getting a non-compliant card. The reason to get a non-compliant card may vary. It could be cost. It could be a person is unwilling or unable to prove lawful presence. It can simply be personal preference. The non-compliant card will lack the Real ID star and include a statement similar to not for federal identification. So that's to be able to tell a physically non-compliant license from a compliant license. In the MDL world, a digital marker will distinguish between a compliant, non-compliant MDL. So whether a physical card or a digital ID, it is up to the relying party to determine what types of licenses to accept, whether and what approach that they're going to take. I now turn you over to Chris to discuss how trust issuance will work specifically for MDLs.
So as Ted just described, in the physical world, there is a, at least in the US for Real ID, the compliance mark is a gold star in the corner of the license. And so that leads relying parties to ask, well, how do we verify the compliance of an MDL? Do we simply look for the gold star on the phone screen as the MDL is presented? So the answer to that is a definitive and absolute no. Phone screens used as a flash pass are not a secure means to transmit data from an MDL to the relying party. Phone apps can be very easily faked and spoofed. Those fake apps can be deployed en masse very simply. Unlike a physical driver's license, you have to physically mail a card or produce a card for each person that wants to use it illegally. It's very trivial to create illicit apps and distribute them widely. So the phone should never be used as a flash pass. The screen information cannot be verified for its authenticity. So in order to verify authenticity in the MDL, relying parties are forced to understand the data elements being passed to them. With one key important fact is that the data elements being passed from the MDL to relying party will have been signed cryptographically by the issuer. So what this means is that the issuer will take their private signing key and wrap the MDL data with a secure signature that the relying party can eventually decode after receiving the data. So the process works such that the MDL holder will pass their data, which has been signed by the issuer, to the relying party. The relying party then accesses a secure cloud to download the public signing certificates, which allows them to decode the signature and check the data is valid. This is done in a cryptographic manner such that only the issuer could have signed the data the relying party is now verifying. And within this data set is where you'd find the compliance mark. In this case, it'd be Real ID status for someone using a checkpoint. So the important takeaways to remember are that because the relying party must go to the cloud to get the issuer signing certificates, the only way for you to really trust an MDL is that you are only accepting MDLs from issuers you trust. It is the responsibility of relying parties to know which issuers they trust. And this can be done through a number of means, things like certification, testing, compliance. Also, state and local authorities may publish lists of trusted issuer certificates. Now, the final step in understanding this process is now that you've received the data and you verify that data from the holder that is legitimate, the last thing to check is the facial image of the holder. So in all transactions, the MDL holder will pass an image that has been taken and signed by the issuer to the relying party. And that relying party can then match the image received with the person standing there, either through a live in-person check or through a means of biometrics such as a facial recognition algorithm. So with that, I'll pass this on to Ariane, who's going to discuss a bit more about the certification and how those technical pieces actually come into play in the real world.
Yeah, so good afternoon and thanks, Chris. I would like to highlight some aspects of testing and certification of MDL processes and solutions and how that contributes to ensuring trust in MDL. So first, I would like to share how testing already has played an important role towards the development of the MDL standard, ISO IEC 18013.5. Then I'll look into different stakeholders' needs for MDL assurance and provide example of what may be covered in conformity assessment. And finally, I'd like to look at harmonizing towards certification and conveying trust. So the next slide. Testing for MDL goes back more than 5 years, around the time that I assumed the task of leading the new ISO task force for MDL standardization. I was involved in a project to add a chip on a driver license card according to ISO 18013 parts 2 and 3, which are heavily based on ICAO standards for biometric passports. Upon rollout, we were asked to test the idea of not only putting a chip on the driver license, but actually doing it the other way around, put a driving license on a chip, which resulted in the first prototype of a SIM card based driver license with Android and Windows Phone apps using NFC. Yeah, so task force, the functional needs that AMFA's Joint Mobile Driving License Working Group had collected and technology concepts from industry came together and led to the first working draft of 1813 Part 5. That led to another testing activity. In 2016 and 17, concepts proposed for standardization were proven in an operational proof of concept by RDW, that is the Netherlands DMV, and AMVA. Next slide, please. Since 2018, a number of test events have been organized to vet the standards, to confirm that it was feasible to implement, to identify any ambiguity that the draft in the draft version of the standard. And those test events were coordinated by UL, endorsed by AMVA and its counterparts from Australasia and Europe, and enjoyed good participation from the ISO group, as you can see from the logos that are on the slide. These test events in Japan, America, and Australia have been very instrumental to continually improve the quality of the standard. Unfortunately, we weren't able to do the standard to confirm the latest draft of the standard that was planned for The Hague for May. We now are looking into alternative ways to have that check on the standard towards October. Next slide, please. As we move towards implementation and rollout of MDL, let's have a look at some primary stakeholders and what their needs for MDL assurance are. So as issuing authorities get ready, they're confronted with many questions and quite some complexities. So what do they need to address to ensure privacy and trust? And to gain driver license holders' trust to go mobile. How can they obtain assurance that their MDL is secure and privacy preserving? And how can they convey such assurance? Maybe the most prominent question and called out extra loud on this slide is the question from the verifier, the relying party. How can I trust the credential that is presented to me? And is that credential good enough for the use case for which I rely on that credential? And next slide, please. Now, the question is, what needs to be addressed to ensure trust in MDL processes and solutions? Now, first I'll speak to the gray boxes on this slide. Issuing authorities should define governing policies governing security, enrollment and issuance processes and technology. Also, requirements should be defined regarding vendor processes and the technology they provide, especially privacy, security and standards conformity. The two areas touched on in these boxes are also the topics that were defined as the most prominent to look at for testing in AMVA's task force for MDL testing. Now, a question is how to go about with these as these policies and requirements are defined. What can we do to provide assurance to that, to ensure trust in these processes and technologies? So a step is to review the policies and audit the against those policies, look at the processes and practices in place to for enrollment and issuance of the MDL. For the technology, if you look at the MDL and MDL reader technology provided, do they conform to standards? That can be assessed in conformity assessment. Are they delivering the privacy promise that can be confirmed in a privacy assessment? is your data really stored as secure as it should, that can be confirmed in security evaluation. The evidence of what is performed in the assurance activities presented in the red boxes results in what in how that the trust in the processes and technology can be conveyed, or what consequence is given to that activity. So issuing authorities accept qualifying technology of qualifying vendors for operational use. Based on evaluated policy and audit against the policy, an issuing authority could publish a part of their security policy and certificate policy, and they should publish the issuing authority CA public key certificate that is used by a verifier to authenticate the MDL that is presented. MDL verifiers should do their due diligence in confirming that indeed the MDLs they want to accept are trustworthy enough for their use case. So they should review issuing authority policies and add the issuing authority CA certificate of those issuing authorities that qualify for their needs to their certificate store or a master list they may use to authenticate MDLs they accept. The next question is, and the next slide, please. Let's first have a look at what could or should be addressed in a standards conformity assessment. So if you look at the MDL technologies that are in the ISO 18013 standards, that includes the data model for the mobile driving license, but it also includes technologies for device engagement to make the first connect between an MDL and a reader. How are QR codes or how is NFC used to initiate the transaction? How is data transferred using Bluetooth Low Energy, Wi-Fi aware of or NFC? How is the interaction over Web API or OpenID Connect between an MDL reader and an issuing authority? Does that meet the requirements set in ISO 18013 and underlying standards that are referenced? Also, for the provisioning, if you look at the interface between an issuing authority and the MDL, that part is not standardized in 18013 part 5, but is incorporated in a standardization activity that takes the MDL to a wider scope and a next level that includes protocols and services for the issuance phase. Next, apart from only functional requirements, technical requirements for functionalities, there are security functions defined, which are presented on the next slide. The most important one is issuer data authentication. That consists of electronically signing the mobile driving license data under the responsibility of the issuing authority. And based on the issuing authority CA root certificate, the MDL reader verifies the signature that was placed on the data, and that is determining whether the data can or cannot be trusted. This is the most fundamental security function and protocol defined in ISO 18013-5. Of course, when it comes to privacy, the communications are encrypted, whether that is for offline using session encryption or online using TLS. And in the online retrieval, a JSON web signature is the equivalent of issuer data authentication. The issuing authority signing the MDL data. Then there is the dynamic authentication between an MDL and MDL reader, where the MDL proves it's the authentic that it is authentic and not a copy from a different device. And reader authentication is provided for an MDL reader to prove that it's authorized to read data or to read certain specific data from an MDL. All of these functions and communication technologies, data formats, message formats, and security functions, including the cryptographic components of that, should be covered in conformity assessment, whether each of these aspects conform to the requirements formulated in the standard. This is an example of what to be covered in conformity assessment. Now, if we look at this is a perspective from a simple ecosystem with one issuing authority, one verifier, and one MDL. On the next slide, there is a representation. What's next? How can we move forward to harmonizing trust in MDL processes and solutions? You see that where initially it's an issuing authority's individual activity to define their policies and processes. But as the market matures, I do anticipate and there is activity towards harmonizing and working towards common policies for security, for enrollment and issuance, also leveraging existing standards around that. If you look at the NIST SP 863 identification assurance level as part of the issuance, the enrollment and issuance process, common requirements for vendors and their technologies. With harmonization of these policies and requirements, there can also be a harmonization of audit and review practices and standards conformity assessment, privacy assessment, and security evaluation, which can, if that is harmonized, be part of a scheme in which certification takes place. And this is very helpful and useful in situations where an issuing authority chooses an implementation model to select a vendor to take care of the MDL solution, of the entire MDL solution for them to receive the evidence or the certificate on their implementation. And also for relying parties, the MDL verifiers, as I mentioned, it would be quite an activity if every relying party would have to go through the policies of each individual issuing authority to see whether that is good enough for their needs. So as we move forward, the harmonized approach to reviewing policies, publishing certificates for regarding these policies, but also regarding the technology implementations, can lead to ways of conveying that trust of certified issuing authority policies, certified technology implementations in master list against which the certification status of issuing authority policies and processes, as well as vendors' technology implementations, can be automatically verified. With that, I would like to hand back to Matt.
Okay, thank you so much. So today's discussion really focused on three interdependent foundational pieces. First, trust and choice. Second, information integrity and confidence. And lastly, which Archie just covered, consistency, security, and safety within the digital environment. And just to quickly recap on those three areas, the first one, trust and choice, John highlighted the privacy-enhancing features of ISO 18013-5 compliant mobile driver's license, discussing really the privacy principles that are incorporated in the standard and its execution, which ensure user choice, user control, and transparency in operation. The second one, which was on information integrity and confidence, covered by Ted and Chris, really discussed the certainty, accuracy, and integrity of the information at the proofing and assessment and the provisioning of technologies. And then Chris went further on the enhancing, how we enhance the integrity and accuracy of the information for relying parties. And then his argument was just covering with respect to consistency, security, and safety in the digital environment, presenting the approach to testing and certification of MDL processes and solutions to ensure the conformance of hardware and software. And then just want to emphasize the fact that the certification structures exist today to ensure confidence and consistency to these principles by really ensuring the conformance of the policies and processes from issuance to relying party transactions. And again, all of this really ladders up to our vision statement that we shared at the beginning of enabling trust and choice in the modern world and how we're working together to develop the future of identity in America. And the closing call to action that I have for all of you is, you know, first recognizing the role that you play in helping us develop this together, and the fact that, you know, attending webinar 4, where we're going to get into the specifics of the working groups and really the actionable next steps and how we're bringing this to market and how we're making this possible. So again, thank you all for your participation and engagement today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Randy for Q&A. Thank you.
We're going to go right to the Q&A now for the few minutes that we have left, but I just wanted to remind those who are still on the call that you'll receive a email message from us after this webinar with the link to the recording and also access to the knowledge assessment quiz if you would be interested in taking that quiz. First question is, I'll send it out to the full team. Can an MDL be used to authenticate one's social security number or some other identity attribute to an online replying party? If not, are there significant changes to an MDL needed before an MDL can be used for an online identity credential?
I'll take the first crack at that. You know, driver's license, just like a physical driver's license card itself, does not contain and a social security number. You know, I wouldn't assume that a MDL would include a social security number. So I think the short answer is no. I mean, I'd separate the concept of mobile driver's licenses versus other types of mobile digital IDs. There's no reason the Social Security Administration could not put out their own mobile version of a Social Security card that would allow that kind of verification. But that's not something, to the best of my knowledge, that is built into driver's license, just like it's not built into a physical driver's license. As a matter of fact, I'm fairly certain it's legally prohibited in most states. However, I will say that on a real ID compliant license, there is a requirement to do a check against the Social Security Administration systems when verifying Social Security numbers.
Thanks, Ted. Question for Arjan, is the ISO standards effort completed? And if not, what are the next steps?
The ISO standardization effort, well, is it ever completed? The standardization of the first edition of the standard is nearly finished. We're currently in the in a 2-week effort to resolve comments on the last voting round that allowed for technical comments on the standard. And we are very close to the finish line of having these issues resolved. It was our after that we'll have an internal review after the resolutions have been applied to the text. What we intended to do, as we did with previous drafts of the standard, to do a test event on top of the normal ISO process to actually confirm again and again and again that what we wrote down and what we standardized is feasible and can be implemented and really works, is really interoperable. So from that perspective, I'm very sorry that we are in the COVID-19 situation and that it hinders us to get together and actually put all the prototype and pre-production versions of the implementations of the standard together and try it all out. It has been an extremely collaborative activity, and the standard is 20 times more precise and accurate than it would have been if we had not engaged in that kind of activity. Still, we have this last round to complete. We do consider doing an alternative to a test event, or have two test events very close to each other late October, after which any issues identified should be processed. But definitely before the end of the year is the intention to launch the version for a final yes-no vote. Once that is out, that's what the world is going to say yes or no to, and that should lead to publication of the international standard by the end of the publication then will de facto take place early next year. But that is what we have ahead for the first edition of the standard. At the same time, we are working on activities to harmonize functions to facilitate these online scenarios or scenarios in which we can further improve privacy. The whole standardization activity has been a constant review on, are we indeed practicing privacy by design, security by design? Here we are looking at, currently we rely on transferring the face image of the holder to confirm that that person is really the person person claims to be. What we are working on is standardizing on-device holder verification, enabling in-person interactions without the need to share in your face image, and also to enable strong holder verification for online situation. And that is something we have deliberately chosen to put in the first edition of the standard what we can guarantee to be as trustworthy as today's physical driving license at a level that is electronically protected at the same level of a biometric passport. So from that perspective, with that in the back of our minds, we have made sure that promise for the first edition. We're now working on the second edition to further bring this into the digital domain as a universal and interoperable credential for offline and online scenarios.
Great. Thank you, Arjan. Next question is for John, and maybe Matt, you could chime in on this as well. You talked about user agreements are often coercive, and end users typically don't understand the legalized language that goes with them. Do you foresee any structure for user terms changing with regard to mobile driver's licenses?
Well, you got another hour. So it's true that depending on the jurisdiction and depending on the context of the transaction, consent is not appropriate. So in the narrow case of the actual creation of the driver's license and you're pulled over by an officer of the law and you're asked to present your driver's license because there's a traffic violation, there's no consent, there's no agreement, it's built into the jurisdiction. On the other end is the use case where people talk about presenting it on entry to a bar to verify that you're of legal drinking age in the agreement. Again, with data minimization and no retention of data, and you simply send the flag back, I'm 19 or 21 or 18 or whatever the age is, and all that the doorman sees at the club is the green line, consent is relatively low and there's not a lot of agreement. So in between those, or on the other end of those, are the things where you want to use the MDL as an in a context where you're applying for a loan or doing something that's more fraught. And then on a case by case, context by context basis, you have to look at what's the nature of the agreement. Is consent appropriate? Is it legitimate interest if we're using GDPR or some other element? It's what the MDL brings is verifiable identity with a level of authority that depends upon the issuing authority and the relying party's dependence on that relying authority. Those frame the discussion about how consent or data sharing is negotiated. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer for that.
Great. Thank you, John. Matt, do you have something to add?
Yeah, I don't. I think calling it coercive is a little bit more aggressive than I was intending. But at the end of the day, I do think we can do a better job of simplifying and clarifying what data needs to be shared, is being shared, and what's being done with it, and kind of humanize the way that we present that that data so that people can make better decisions about what they're sharing and how it's being used. Today, having it buried in, you know, a EULA is probably not the easiest to use or digest way of doing it. So I just think we can do better in an MDL context than we do today. That was my main point.